Today we're going to pick up actually with part four of this study. And last week I had, as I got further into the study, I'm covering more and more things and still the same amount of time. So the packet is getting thicker and thicker. And I've got them again, and they're thick. So I apologize in advance for that. I will try not to cover all of this, because if I do, you'll be here for an hour and a half. I've got section 1, 2, and 3 that we did over here on the table. So if you want to get any of the handouts, they're there. 1, then 2, and then 3. And then this is 4. And we're going to go through. I'm going to skip a lot of this. I won't say skip it. I'm going to cover it pretty quickly and leave it to your exercise to read it at home. Because the topic we're going to cover today is a topic that brings us actually through the Middle Ages and up through the Reformation. Each one of those is a full topic that you could cover in this time. But let me just start by where we were, and I'm going to do this pretty quick. This is what we covered last time. We covered where Constantine became the emperor and converted to Christianity, and all the problem it caused, and the doctrine of the Trinity, and how they had to come back and settle on that, and how they had to go after the heresies by putting creeds out, and the creeds were the things that begin to drive consistency in the faith, but it also began to drive up the power of the papacy and all of the church structure, and a lot of people rejected that in some senses, and they wanted to become more monastic and wanted to get away from all of that pomp and ceremony, and so all of the monks, the movement of monasticism began in Europe. At that time, Augustine was probably one of the best and brightest to come out of that period, had intense effect on the Roman church at that time. And up until this time, we studied last week, and this is, I guess, around maybe 500 or 600 AD. I'd have to go look it up exactly. It's Pope Gregory. We'll get to him in a minute. The papacy really didn't exist. There was a bishop of Rome, and there were bishops of all the other areas. But in about right after the time of Pope Gregory, or Bishop Gregory of Rome, he declared himself to be the head of all the bishops, the big bishop, so to speak. And that's when they started doing the papacy. And then what they did was they went back and took every other bishop of Rome back to the beginning and in retrospect declared them popes, you know, and wrote their little book about the history of the popes. But that was all done after about 500 or 600 AD. It wasn't part of the beginning. But the Eastern Orthodox, we talked a little bit about them and how they came to be different and what their plan of salvation was and how it's different from the ones we have and how they sort of view this perfect picture of God and how when we fail that, we have to go back and renew those symbols of God. And that's why the term between heaven and hell, because we're always somewhere in between perfect and not perfect. And, you know, we always have to go back and restore it. That's the way they are. And then we talked a little bit about how the popes wanted to convert the people in Europe, and they sent missionaries up to do that, missionaries in the form of monks. And we've done through this, the age of the Christian Roman Empire. We're going to start today. I'm trying to cover the Middle Ages and the age of the Reformation. And then this one will even be more challenging probably next week. But we'll try to get as much of this done as we can. I'd actually like to save a little time at the end of this one next week to talk about where we are and where we go. And we'll see about that. I may just cut some of this down or put it in the notes and just let you take a look at it. So we're going to cover two key topics today. We're going to cover the Christian Middle Ages. We're going to cover the Reformation. Underneath each one of these is the things I'm going to talk about. Some of them I've talked a little bit about before, and I'm going to blow through them pretty quickly, but you will have in your handouts the text and stuff if we were to do this in a longer fashion. And then Reformation, we're going to talk about what happened in the church and why it began to crack at the seams and what caused that crack, and then four of the early traditions that came out of that crack, and then all of the other things that began to happen that bring us right up to the time where America is being formed and the first colonies are here and what that looks like. We're going to just touch that today, and then we're going to pick that up next week. So Gregory the Great, I talked about him. Gregory the Great was a politician in Rome who was a monk. and he really enjoyed being an abbot in the monk in the monkery there, and so he was having a good time doing that. But the Pope died, and they wanted him to become the Pope. He didn't want to become the Pope. He had been the Roman mayor, but he was an ascetic. He didn't like all the pomp and circumstance, and so when they tried to get him to do that, he ran. They caught him, drug him back, and made him the Pope. But he did a good job because he was a very, very organized guy. He organized the papacy and began to organize things and begin to put structure in place. And his status in the early church gained him this title of Pope. And so after he's dead, by the way, they call him Gregory the Great. And then they sort of canonize him as a Pope. And then they build this train back from him back to the earlier. So it's, probably 600 A.D. after he dies, maybe 615 or 620 when they do all that in terms of the Pope. Now, along with the Pope being down there, just pause on this for a second. All of Europe doesn't look like it looks today. Europe is just a mass area with about 15 tribes of or clans, whatever you want to call it, of people. You had the Angles. You had the Saxons, you had the Franks, you had the people who came down from Scandinavia, the Vikings, you had the, I've got them all listed in there. You got the Bavarians, the Goths, the Visigoths, there's five or six of them, the Lombards, there's a bunch of them. And all they did was fight and kill each other for territory. And they each had these little, they carved out these little empires, and they really cover the areas that we would call Czechoslovakia now, Hungary, Austria, Germany, the Netherlands, all of that area, and they go down into France, and all these little tribes of people. Well, they were not inclined to Christianity, let me put it that way. But the Franks began, they were the most powerful of all the tribes, and the Franks began to conquer other people, and the guy that was the head Frank, if you will, a guy named Clovis, accepted the Nicene Creed, and he was baptized by the church, and so he became a Christian. Now, nominal Christian for sure, but he supported the church. They've built statues of him and all that stuff. So he's kind of the first one to begin to move into the heart of the German area up there to become part of the Roman church. And as a part of that, after he's gone, a guy named Charles comes in, and Charles is king of the Franks in 1768. He strongly supports the Roman Church. He later becomes Charlemagne. You can argue whether that's Charles the Magnificent or Charles the Great. I've seen it both ways. But he strongly supports the church. And the Pope at this time, the ones after Gregory, have begun to have problems because they're being attacked from the west. They're being attacked from the east. They're afraid of the Huns, they're afraid of the Turks, they're afraid of all of these tribes that are trying to take over the Roman Empire. And so what happens is, in Italy, in about 800, the Italian nobles accuse Pope Leo of embezzlement. It's kind of interesting. And they're going to come get him. And so he flees up to France and up to where Charles is. And he goes up there, and of course, King Charles acquits him of all charges. But he decides then he's going to stay up there because it's a little more protection for him. And what he does in return is he turns around because he's Pope, and he names Charles to be the Holy Roman Empire, the head of the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So this becomes a kind of a really interesting deal. Charles or Charlemagne has protected this Pope. This Pope now names him Emperor. So they've got this power thing where they share power and they begin to control things. And this works for a while. And so, as I mentioned here, but the powerful thing here is the church had never created an emperor before. The emperors had always been elected by the soldiers. So this is the first time that the church creates an emperor. And of course, that elevates the stature of the church. And of course, since he accepted it, it elevates his stature. They're both now on a par, but they respect each other and they go along. But Charles begins to take over, and if you look up Charlemagne, you will find tons of stuff he did, good stuff he did for the church and for the empire at that time. And he controlled very well what was going on. Really a good king in a lot of ways. Not that he didn't kill his enemies, but he was a good king in a lot of ways, if you look at it that way. But what happens to the church is an interesting thing. There's a couple of controversies, and somebody asked me last week to talk a little bit about the split between the Eastern and Western churches. And I want to talk about that because the Orthodox Church, we call it the Greek Orthodox today or the Russian Orthodox, but it was just the Orthodox Church then. There were three things that happened that really drove that split. The first one was the what they call the Filioque controversy. That's a French word, by the way, and it means the son of. Then there was the Great Schism. We'll talk about that in the Fourth Crusade. The Filioque controversy, or Filioque controversy, means and the son. The Nicene Creed, which the church had adopted, said the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. In the Western Church, they added and the Son, proceeds from the Father and the Son. And the Eastern Church didn't get to vote on that. It wasn't part of the bishops. They just added it in there. And so they didn't like it at all. This creed had been into effect for about 300 years. And they'd all acknowledged this creed and they'd move forward. So the Western Church added this, Western Church meaning the Roman Church, added and the Son to that creed in English. And so that became a giant controversy between the two. And Photius, who was bishop of Constantinople, if you remember, that's where Constantine set up his head of the Roman Empire, pretty powerful guy. I'm not sure he looked exactly like that, but it's a good picture of him anyway. He decided that it was heretical. He excommunicated the Pope, which, of course, didn't sit real well with the Pope. So he excommunicated the Pope, and the feud went on. The churches had already begun to split a little bit. And in about another 150 years, the Pope sent bishops over and cardinals over to Constantinople and excommunicated them. So they laid a bill of excommunication, a papal bull, on the Lord's Supper table of the Church of the Holy Wisdom in Constantinople. That's that church today, by the way. But what was interesting in it, the papal accusation accused them of adding this Filioque to the Nicene Creed. And it was exactly the other way around. So they proposed the heresy and kicked them out, excommunicating for that. And so that was exactly the opposite of what happened. So you've got the controversy, and then you've got the trading of insults, so to speak, each one excommunicating the other one. And then we've got the Crusades. And I'll get to the Fourth Crusade in a minute. So the popes all this time are fighting over their territory. They're arguing with emperors. They've got all these battles going on against the Lombards and all these people up in Europe. And what happens is the Turks take over Jerusalem. And that's just horrible. And so the Pope calls, Pope Urban, calls for a crusade to go back and take Jerusalem. Actually, this first crusade is really the only one that was successful. We'll talk a little bit about that. And the Pope promised anyone who participated that would be their equivalence of penance. So if they had done anything wrong in their life, this was their chance to get back in good graces with the church to go down and fight this crusade, you know, on behalf of God. And you can see the picture of the crusade over there. I'm sure that's some artist rendering, but in fact, in the notes, it'll tell you who painted that. But the first crusade was in 1099, and they did take over Jerusalem. The problem with it was, while doing that, they also slaughtered a lot of Jews and Muslims in there that were not fighting. They were just living in the area. They also slaughtered some Christians, by the way, the Coptic Christians and some of those that lived in Egypt and happened to be in Jerusalem. So even though it was a success in many ways, they recaptured it. It sowed a lot of seeds of problems. And you can see this doesn't take very long. Another 100 years or so, the Turks are back. And so they launch a second crusade, but they can't really take these lands back from the Muslims. And so they lost that. The third crusade failed also. None of these crusades were successful. And then you get to the Fourth Crusade, which is really the big item that caused the final split. Fourth Crusade was in 1200, and the Crusaders were coming from the eastern part of Europe, and they were coming down, and they decided to make a detour through Constantinople. And when they did, they got into a bunch of things like who's going to pay for it and what are they going to do and is the money supposed to be there for all the soldiers that are coming? And things didn't happen like that. And so what happened was the Crusaders tore through the walls of Constantinople and just pillaged, plundered, raped, killed all the Christians that were there in the name of Christ. So not a good mark on the crusade. This fourth crusade is really the thing that broke this camel's back. So from then on, the churches were forever split. They did try to fix this, and I'll just tell you, 2004, Pope John declared that, you know, that they're, you know, regretful that it was Catholic or Latin Christians that did that. But, I mean, here we are 1,000 years later, and in, you know, basically the silence of the church for 1,000 years in what went on there, kind of like if we don't say anything, nobody will notice it. But that really never, the church relation between the Orthodox and the Roman Church never really recovered from that. We'll go on here. So all of this time, we're back in Europe now, reset back to Europe. So back in Europe, they're going to go back and try to get all these tribes back in line with the Roman Empire. So what they do is they send these monks all the way through Europe to go work among the people, build monasteries. And if you've ever been to Europe, there's monasteries everywhere. And there's monks that are cloistered in there. And we went through last week a little bit about what a monk is and what a nun is and how that came to be. But, you know, they built all these wonderful things. And through their farming relationships, through their interaction with people, they begin to get questions about who this God was that they served. And they begin to very quietly begin to minister in the area. And so through the relationships that they built, they were able to minister to all of these pagans who were such bloodthirsty people up in that area. You know, we think about the Vandals, and we use the term Vandal today for somebody that breaks in and steals something, but Vandals were people. And, you know, we talk about people who come in with a dead look, like they're Goths or Visigoths or whatever, but these are names of tribes that were actually in existence, you know, back in the Middle Ages. By the late 1800s, the monasteries were beginning to come into a chance of, they were controlled by the local princes, and they were not doing what they were supposed to do, and so there were some things that had to happen. This guy, Duke William, who was in France, wanted to build one that was not controlled by nobles and kings, and this monk named Berno said, well, why don't we use your hunting castle? So his castle in Cluny became the first of these non-papal ordained monasteries. And it's still there if you actually go look at it. But, you know, he deeded it to the apostles Peter and Paul. I'm not sure how they ever claimed that deed. But, you know, he took it out of the hands of the church. He didn't give it to the church. And so that became a self-funded, self-ordained sort of a mission. Now, I'm going to do this very quickly, but there was a guy in Damascus called John of Damascus who was very important also. And one of the things that was interesting from him is the Muslims had now taken over Syria, and he had a very powerful position within the church. But other Christians accused him of problems, and so what happened was the Muslim court cut off his right hand and executed him, or sent him off to a monastery, exiled him. Didn't kill him, though, which is kind of interesting. And we see a difference in the Muslims of today and the Muslims of this year. Because in this time, they were much more tolerant of the other religions. They wanted to control, but they would allow them to live there under certain things. And this John began this discussion about icons. And the Eastern Church has a big thing with icons and how icons were, when did they become icon worship and when did they become just a symbol of our deepening faith? And he did a lot of work doing that. He reverenced icons, but he rejected icon worship, and that got him into some trouble with some parts of the other church, and the Eastern Church, and the empire. The emperor that was running that part of that half of the empire accused him of plotting against the Muslims to get rid of him, and so they exiled him off. So I guess all I would say is don't be surprised if you read church history and there's stuff in there you would say, oh my gosh, how did this ever happen? And it happened because power and absolute power and control sometimes dominate the way people think and act. And that's certainly the case in the church then. Now, I brought this up, and I've got one little note in here, and I'm glad Ron is in here, because the King of Moravia, which is over near, it's kind of Bohemia, it's Czechoslovakia, asked for people to come up and minister to the Czech Republic. And they sent this bishop of Constantinople, sent a guy named Cyril and his brother Methodius to go and look at it. And I just looked at that and I thought, who does that look like? Looks like your brother Bob Merritt. Doesn't it look like him? And he's even journaling. So, I mean, I just looked at that and I said, here's Bob Merritt is on a somewhere out in front of a castle somewhere. But anyway, they sent this guy Cyril over. And the only reason that's interesting is because he developed an alphabet to try to convince the Moravians, because he didn't speak their language, to come to Christ. The Moravians couldn't understand his alphabet and his translations, but his mission didn't do much. But in Bulgaria, kind of along the way, they adopted his alphabet, and it became the Cyrillian alphabet that you see today, which is part of Russia and a lot of other things. So we look at these things and we don't know where they come from. This came from a monk who was trying to witness to them and teach them about the Bible, so he created a language that he could use to witness to them. And so the Cyrillic alphabet is part of Bulgaria and Albania and Russia and a lot of those countries that run up through the north of the Black Sea and run up on into Russia. And so, they led many people to Christ. And you could say, really, the Russian Orthodox Church's formation and acceptance of Christ really comes from this set of activities that these monks did. And so even though it didn't do much during his lifetime, the legacy lived far beyond his imagination in terms of what it did for Christ. And so they sent all these monks out. They're out there trying to minister, and the wheels start coming off the wagon. You know, the things just aren't working the way they're supposed to. And something kind of funny happens. I'm supposed to speed that up, but it didn't go so fast, did it? In 1294, a Franciscan monk, and if you know anything about Franciscan monks, they're pretty peaceful. They don't like a lot of the trappings. They're kind of quiet. Most of the Franciscan monks are the ones that settled out through the west part of the U.S. The Franciscan monks had the, what do they call those things out there? All the things out west where the shrines and all that they have. And so the Franciscan monks did that. So he comes into Rome to be pope. He comes in barefooted, trying to shun the trappings. He can't stand it. And in a couple of years, he leaves. Five months later, he can't stand it. He can't stand the trappings of it. It's too much for him. So he goes back to his monastic life, goes back into the abbot, and does what he wants. And they think he was probably actually murdered by people that didn't want him talking about why he rejected the papacy. Which is kind of interesting also, Celestine V. But what happens there, how good is that? And in conclusion, let me get back here. Okay. Now back. I think it would not happen. Sorry about that. So Boniface comes in, and he... Because he's having trouble, he just declares himself to have power over all these people up in Europe. They don't take it too well because the King of France kidnaps him and hauls him off to his castle, and he dies there. And so what does the king do? The king, there's another pope named, and because the same things are happening in the city, he flees up next to the King of France in Avignon. And so he's protected up there by the King of France. So for more than 70 years, the popes lived up there, and they didn't live in Rome because they were afraid to go back into Rome because of all the corruption. It's called the Babylonian captivity of the Roman Catholic Church. Kind of an interesting. They really weren't hauled off. They left themselves out of fear of being killed. But at the same time, the plague is going on. And this is a pretty disgusting picture of rats all over England, but that's the way it was. It probably came from a flea on a rat. But in 1347, the Black Plague began to strike in England and all through Europe and down into Italy. And just to give you by the numbers, 23 million people died. I mean, we think about bird flu, we think about swine flu, we think about, all these things that, 100 people die across the world. 23 million people died from this. They had no protection. In Constantinople, 88% of the population died. So this former seat of the Holy Roman Empire 88% of the people die from this. In Paris, 800 people every day were dying, and they had carts. They just throw them on the carts and take them outside the city and burn them because they didn't want any of that infection to stay around. Pretty grim. If you ever studied the plague, from a medical perspective, that's what everyone fears with these runaway plagues. They fear something like this, and the plague actually killed off one of the popes earlier, but the popes living up in France were less affected for it. But after the plague, there was some healing needed in the Roman Empire. This Catherine of Siena pleaded with the Pope, Pope Gregory VI at this time, to come back, and he does. So he comes back into Italy. So what happens is he comes back in, but then he dies, and the cardinals appoint another Italian pope to appease the people. They were still ticked about the 70 years they'd lived up in France. And so they do this, but that doesn't sit well. So what happens is when Pope Gregory died, when Urban refused to do what the cardinals wanted, these are the cardinals in Rome, they replaced him with a bishop from France. So, not only was the Pope having trouble controlling the lands, but he was having trouble controlling his own bishops and cardinals. And so when they didn't do what he wanted, they deposed him. The problem with that was he didn't leave. And so now they had two popes. They had a pope in Italy and they had a pope in France. And so this was the beginning of the split of the Western Church called the Western Schism. And in an effort to end that, that didn't work very well. For 100 years, it didn't work very well. Finally, they decide they're going to have a council to agree on a pope. So they get all these cardinals from both lands together, they hash it out, and they agree on a new pope. So they depose the other two popes, and they have another pope to come in. The problem with that is the two popes that were deposed wouldn't leave. So now you have three popes and not two. So, I guess it's kind of the, if two is good, then three is better. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And it's all about power. It's all about power, and it's all about control. It's not about what's good for the church. It's not about any of that. They all wanted the power and the control, and they thought they were God's personal vicar on earth for everything, that their decisions were, not challengeable. And, of course, the other parts of the church didn't like that. And along with that comes a guy named Wycliffe. Wycliffe is an Englishman, and he comes out with this pretty interesting theory that the church itself is not built on popes or sacraments or councils, that it's built on the people. So the people of God are really the church. It's not, it's not the institution of the church. This gets him into a lot of trouble. He's an Oxford professor. He's teaching at Oxford. He's got a lot of students listening to him. But remember, England is a Roman Catholic country at this time, and the kings do homage to the popes. And so they begin to bracket him down. They send him off to this little monastery about 50 or 60 miles outside of London, make him stay there. But he continues to write, and he continues to translate the Bible into English because he's got this theory that if people could read the Bible themselves, then they could divine what God's will was for their life, and they wouldn't need somebody to explain it to them. Well, that doesn't go over real well either, and he develops this English translation. But the seeds that he planted are seeds that never go away. And a lot of people think about the Reformation and think of Luther, but he was probably the first one to begin the seeds of Reformation. And so he dies. And he leaves a legacy of all the people he's trained. Oh, by the way, he does little Bible studies around in his area, so he's training people kind of on the quad up there. And people are doing that. Now, at the same time, the King of England is married to a queen from what we call Bohemia, which is Prague, or it's in Czechoslovakia. And so the pathways are burning up back and forth. The travel is good back and forth to there. So a lot of these people that were being taught by Wycliffe migrate over to Prague because there's less people watching over there. They can kind of do what they want to do. So they go to Prague, and one of the guys that they talk to is a guy named John Huss, anglicized, it's John. And he embraced his teachings and began to preach them from the pulpit. Now, the church figured out, they thought they'd killed off Wycliffe and all of his heresies. And when this guy started up, they actually caught him and burned him alive at the stake. And the interesting thing about it is, he was an honorable theologian. And the church said, we don't understand what you're teaching, come explain it to us. And so he did. And when they did, that was the start of the Inquisition. He was one of its first victims. They inquired, they didn't like it, and they burned him at the stake. So he was really the beginning of the Inquisition. And not only were they ticked at him, they went back to England and dug up Wycliffe's bones and burned all those too, just to make sure they made the statement back to the people. So what happens is this little movement begins to go underground. But the foundations are there. And there's a lot of underground movements going on. There's one called Common Life, turns into a brethren movement. This guy, Thomas Kempis, is one. He writes some books on that. But they sort of got into some mystical devotion here, almost spiritual, more than we think about. But this begins to permeate Holland. And there's a lot of things going on that begin to permeate. And then we come to year 1453. And this is the one year that I've got three or four facts about that you need to see. First of all, the Hundred Years' War is here. This is when all the Germans and everybody are killing each other, trying to establish, you know, dominance there. And the English are driven back to the British Isles. We think of the Anglos and the Saxons as English, but they're really German. They were German tribes that took over England. And so the Anglo-Saxons were really German tribes. And if you look at the kings of England today, you look at, you know, the Queen Elizabeth, and you look at all of them, they're actually German history. Their Windsors are German heritage, which is kind of interesting. We don't think about that, but they are. But most of the intellectual and aristocrats in Europe came from a German heritage, because that's where all of these tribes came from. And that's where all the kings started out. You know, they moved over time. So the Hundred Year Wars ends. Britain goes back. The Ottoman Muslims have actually gone into Constantinople and taken the city away. We know that city today as Istanbul. It's the same city. The Eastern Church begins to adapt and begins to move to Greece. And they pack up everything. They move their as many of their priests and everything they can, and their sacred objects. They pack them up and they move them. But on May 28th, all of the Orthodox and Catholic people there came for one last service in the, I don't know how you pronounce that, Hagia Sophia, I guess. And the next day, the church becomes a mosque. And this is a picture of it today. It's actually a museum today. But the church was converted into a mosque, and they put all these minarets around it. And so much like the Dome of the Rock was built where the temple was in Jerusalem, that's what the Muslims do when they take over. They sort of kind of stamp out as much of the religion and governance of the earlier people. So it becomes, a mosque and a museum. Never to return, by the way. It's been a Muslim country ever since. And the country of Turkey, of course, where a lot of the early church was, is now in Muslim hands. Although secular Muslims, if there's such a thing, secular Muslims, which is good. Now, many of the Christian scholars ran away. They fled towards Rome. They stopped in Greece and other places. They took all the manuscripts they had, early New Testament manuscripts, a lot of the original language writings of some of the early, not the apostles, but some of the people that wrote, you know, like Origen and some of the other people that wrote, they had early copies of those. They took all of that stuff with them. And all these Greek manuscripts engendered a whole new Renaissance period within Europe and around, because they had all these new things for people to study and read. And remember, you had educated and you had the peasants. It was still kind of a serf-type kingdom. And so the educated people began to read and study all these other languages, arts, and writings. And they called themselves humanists because they focused on practical human actions and interests. So humanist really is not a new term, it's an old term, although it's been redefined quite a bit in our modern culture. But all of this begin to go back, and now they begin to take a look at the New Testament again. And if you remember, in the Roman Church, the Latin Vulgate was the document of record. It was translated by Jerome hundreds of years before, sort of a private translation. He sort of fixed a few things to make it fit what they wanted in the translation. And so that was the standard. And when they begin looking at the Greek versus the Latin, they begin to see things that didn't really jive. And so a whole set of renewal begins to happen there. And also that year, Gutenberg makes his movable type press. And so everything that was written began to be printed and began to be distributed. And so all these books begin to come out, the classics, Greek and Roman classics, all these early church letters begin to flood the market as this Gutenberg press begin to make something happen that had never happened before in the history of the church. And out of this whole thing comes this guy, Luther. And that's actually John Calvin over there. It's not Luther. There's a picture of Luther later in here. This is King Henry. So a wild boar gets in the vineyard, and the Reformation begins. If you know, a vineyard is a peaceful place where vines are. And what does a wild boar with his tusks do when he gets into something? Just tears it up. So they considered, in fact, when they excommunicated Luther, they said a wild boar has gotten into the vineyard, and they excommunicated him. And so that's why that title is kind of an appropriate title for him. But Martin Luther had been a peasant, and somebody had sort of taken an interest in him and sent him off to school, and he became very educated. And he was on his way to become a lawyer, but he was walking through a little mining town in Germany, and he got struck by lightning. And to tell you how good a Catholic he was struck by lightning, and he fell on the ground, and he started praying to St. Anne, who was the patron saint of the miners, and told her that if she would save his life, he would become a monk. Well, he lived, and much to his parents' dismay, he honored that and went off to become a monk and lived in the monkery and did whatever monks do in the monkery. But he threw himself into it. You know, he disciplined himself. He didn't eat much. He worked hard. He fasted all the time. And he almost died from his discipline on himself because he was aware of his own sin. And he knew he was a sinner, and he was aware of God's righteousness. And he had trouble bridging that gap. And while he was studying the Greek New Testament, he began to study the words of Christ from the cross. And it's in my notes somewhere. In Matthew, the words are, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so Luther was feeling forsaken himself. And so he said, well, wait a minute. I'm feeling forsaken, but I'm not righteous. Christ was righteous. He lived a sinless life. There was no reason for him to be that way. So the whole idea about, you know, how are you redeemed, how are you placed righteous before God, couldn't be based on what I did in my life. It had to be on something else. And he started studying that, and he came into the passages of Paul, and he got into that passage I've also footnoted in there that says, you know, the righteous are saved by faith. And it took him a little time. But he said that line in Paul's gospel, it's in Romans, I believe, and says that became his gateway to heaven because he saw that it wasn't by what you did, it was by who you were and what you believed. And so he began to say, well, I understand grace. I can forgive myself now because God forgives me. You know, it's not my sin that keeps me away from him. It's my relationship with him. And so Luther begins to not only see this, but he begins to teach it, and he begins to talk about it. And the other thing he hated in the Roman Church, aside from the worldliness of the popes, he didn't like that because he was a monk. He didn't like all those trappings. But the other thing he didn't like is he didn't like the sale of indulgences. He thought it was not right for the bishops to say, okay, so you committed this sin? Let me see, that's $400 and this, and if you do this, then I'll forgive your sin. And because it was just a racket to make money for the church. And so he believed that was terrible, and he didn't believe that this belief of the Roman Church that they could absolve sin was accurate, and so he began to speak out against that, and of course that got him into a lot of trouble. Pope Leo X, lots of Leos by the way. So Martin Luther wanted to debate the validity of these things, so he wrote all of his questions and complaints down and nailed them on the chapel door in Wittenberg, Germany. We see those pictures of Luther nailing the 95 theses or questions, topics for debate on the chapel door. And so that's what got him in trouble. And so they wrote this papal bull, and they had him excommunicated as a heretic. And Pope Leo said, you know, a wild boar has invaded the Lord's vineyard, which is kind of interesting. But what happened was he became representative of everybody who was beginning to protest what was going on. And the reason they become called Protestants, or Protestants as we call them today, is when a Roman Catholic prince decided he was going to outlaw any belief in Lutheranism in his territory, some of the Lutherans got so upset about it and protested so harshly they called him Protestants or Protestants. And so that name really stuck for everybody who was against what the church was teaching. And so it not only described Lutherans, but all the other churches that began to separate from the Roman Catholic Church. We'll talk about four basic ones of those. But while this is going on, there's a guy in France. His name is Jean Covin. We call him John Calvin. We think of him as English because his name is John Calvin, but it's really as Jean Covin. He is a Frenchman. And he's a lawyer, a very smart guy, and he began to look at Luther's ideas and begin to adopt them and think they were really good. And of course, what happened was they thought they, you know, stamped it all out. And when Calvin shows up to preach it in France, they drive him out. So he runs from France and he runs up to Geneva, which is a little less watched. And he begins to study up there, and he takes a position as the head of the New Testament studies or something up in Geneva. And he begins to teach this. And just for a little bit of time, he's run out and he's come back. But most of his time is spent in Geneva. He adds a couple of twists, however. He wrote this thing called the Institutes of Religion. He's really, we kind of think about him as the father of the Reform movement, which we call Presbyterianism today. But there's a couple of other things that take place. John Knox gets involved in this. But Calvin's big deal was not this indulgences. It was not some of that. His big deal was the sovereignty of God. And so he thought the sovereignty of God was important. I'll get to this in a second. So he thought the sovereignty of God was important. And the sovereignty in God said that God knows now who's going to be saved and who isn't. And so we begin to see the seeds of what we call today predestination begin to be planted. And Calvin is a predestination person. And of course, the other side of that is free will. And somewhere in between free will and God knowing everything is the right answer. Hard to pin down. Calvin's over here. The real true free willers are over here. But he starts this whole thinking process. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But a guy named John Knox, who is in Scotland, starts to read about what Calvin's doing, starts to take it to heart. And of course, the Scots didn't like the English. They didn't like the Catholics or the Anglicans. They didn't like any of those. So this is a new religion for them, and so they adopt it. And so Presbyterianism becomes part of Scotland. We think of, if you say Presbyterianism, we all think of Scotland. We think that's where it came from. It really didn't. It came from France, but it migrated there, just like seeds take root in various places. This seed took root there. And so the Reformed Church began to be formed there. But John Knox was actually a Calvinist when he started. But Calvin was not the only reformer. Remember this little brotherhood of believers in all of the Dutch areas and the Swiss areas? A guy named Zwingli had a church that he began to teach some of these things. And part of this group was known as the Swiss Brethren. And their big deal, they had a lot of big deals, but one of them was infant baptism. The church prescribed infant baptism because the state and the church were the same. And when you were born, you joined the church and you were just baptized and you were considered a Christian in the church. They thought that was not apostolic and not correct. And so they started this thing that we call believer's baptism today. And the church came down on them hard. And they, in the dead of night, they went out into a room and they decided to pledge their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honors, just like our founding fathers, on this idea. And so they all baptized each other in a show of strength. And they became known as Anabaptists or rebaptizers or again baptizers. But they rejected that because they said the first baptism wasn't valid. So they preferred to be called Baptists, but they were really called Anabaptists. The Baptist faith that we know, we come from a little bit different line in here. But so they began to do this. And out of this comes a lot of things we know today. A guy named Menno Simons was a leader in this early church over there, and we know him today as the Mennonites, father of the Mennonites. So all the Mennonites, just like the Lutherans followed Luther and the Mennonites followed Menno, well, they're really Anabaptists in some form, but they're Congregationalists, and there's a lot of different little splinter groups, you know, the Old Order, the New Order, the Mennonites, the Brethren, the Amish. There's all different varieties of this, but they're all kind of branches off the same root that came out of this Anabaptist movement. Tyndale, an Englishman at the time, begins to look at translating the Bible. He's seen the copy that was done before, and so he begins to take a look at it, and he wants to make it so that anybody can read and understand the Bible. And again, the church doesn't like this. And so they bought everything up that he had done and had printed, and they burned them all and to get rid of him. And King Henry VIII, there's a whole story about him, and I know I'm running short of time, so I'll blast through this. King Henry VIII, his wife, Catherine of Aragon, was 40 years old. She had five children, but all but one had died. And the one that lived was Mary, and she was Mary of Tudor. And so he was concerned he was not going to have a male heir. So he went to the Pope and said, I need you to annul this marriage. And the Pope said, well, I don't think so. Not because of any moral issue, but because Catherine of Aragon was the aunt of the current Holy Roman Emperor. And so he took a dim view of it. Therefore, the Pope took a dim view of it. So he wouldn't do it. So Henry said, well, fooey on you. I'll seize all your property. I'll declare this is the Church of England. I'll set up my own cardinals. I'll set up my own archbishop. And then I'll declare myself head of the church. And when I do, then I'll declare myself a noble. And I'll marry Anne Boleyn. And he marries Anne Boleyn. And you know the story there. She's accused of adultery. I don't know whether she did that or not. But anyway, he cuts her head off. But she had no male heirs either. She had one girl, Elizabeth I. So he marries another woman called Jane Seymour. And she has one male heir called Edward, Edward the 6th or 7th or whatever. I'll get to it in a minute. And so when Henry dies, Edward takes over. By the way, Tyndale was caught, captured, and burned at the stake, by Henry VIII. Not the most pleasant of guys. But anyway, so he wanted a Bible in English now for the English church, but he couldn't dare use the one that had been done earlier because he'd killed them all off. So he basically has another Bible commission called the Great Bible, which is a compilation of the other two, and it's kindly revised, but it's not called Tyndale's, and it's not called Wycliffe's either. It's called the Great Bible or Geneva Bible. And so he puts that in the Church of England. That really becomes the first English Bible. But when he dies, this young guy, Edward, takes over, and he's young. He's not married. He doesn't have any children. And he continues this Protestantism. But when he dies, Mary of Tudor takes over, and she's Catholic. So she kicks them all out. She has the Archbishop of Canterbury and 300 of his closest advisors killed. She brings the popes back in. She starts this whole thing over again. And so 300 people were killed. The popes take over. But she has no children. And when she dies, Elizabeth takes over, which was his daughter by Anne Boleyn. She's Protestant. So she reverts back to the Protestant side, and they reset up all the stuff that they've done. And Mary of Tudor was really called Bloody Mary because of all the people she killed, but she was a good queen, aside from that minor fact, I guess. And Queen Elizabeth decided that she wasn't going to pick Catholicism or this pure reform movement. She was going to pick something in the middle, and she called it Anglicanism. And that's really where the Church of England is today. It's kind of a middle movement between Catholicism and reform. It sort of does a lot of things in the church. Now, it's modified itself over years, but it started out as a middle movement. And somebody's phone there. So the popes tried to fix all this and bring them all together and get the church back together, but three issues were clouding it: papal authority, the presence of Christ in the communion. We talked about that last week. Grace versus works. Those were things the Protestants wouldn't give in on. And so what did the popes do? They excommunicated all of them. So it didn't work, so they excommunicated them all. And they declared that works were necessary. They declared the Protestants heretics. And they declared the selling of indulgence and authority and celibacy all to be the right and divine right of the popes. And, of course, that's really where the basic forever split of these two. Now, we talked about Calvin, but and somewhere, Jim, you may know this, I think this guy was his son-in-law, but I'm not sure, Jacob Arminius. And he really was a Calvinist, but he developed some different thinkings. He started thinking that this was kind of crazy, all this Calvinist stuff. And so he, 5 points of Calvinism are this: no human desires God by nature, every person is spiritually dead. A lot of these we can get along with, by the way. Number two is if someone trusts Jesus because God chose to regenerate that person. Well, that begins to get a little bit narrow there. Jesus died for everyone who would trust in him. In other words, Jesus didn't die for everyone, it was just those that would trust for him. When God regenerates someone, that person will not reject God's grace. Every authentic believer will persevere in the faith and good works until the end. And this is really the predestination. If you're chosen by God, then you're chosen by God. And once you're saved, you can't deny that. You can't fall away from it. But in this view, God did the John 3:16 for all is not part of their theology. They think it's for all who believe, not for all. Basic difference in theology, and Arminius didn't like that. I put this in for you to look at. I'm not going to go through it, but this sort of is the two differences. We don't go with this one totally, but we don't go with that one totally either. We sort of are a blend of these two. This one has modified itself since Arminian, because this whole deal about falling from grace is an interesting subject. And Baptists have a different belief. The Arminians began to say that you could fall from grace. And of course, the Calvinists believe you can't. Once you're saved, you're always saved. So we've sort of adapted the middle position on that. You can read this just for your entertainment. Tulip is the way you can remember the things about Calvin. Those are the verses that they go to. But anyway, all of this stuff began to happen, and King James now comes in. And King James is like a son of Elizabeth. Elizabeth, not the first, though. Son of one of the second ones. I don't remember exactly which one. I think it's in the notes. But he comes in, and he decides he's going to do this Hampton Court thing. And he decides, I've got a list of what that is in there, too. And he decides he's going to make some changes. And they don't like this Geneva Bible because all the notes in the Geneva Bible are Calvinist notes. So he doesn't like the Calvinist notes. So he wants a new Bible. These reformers who are trying to reform the Church of England are trying to say, if it's not in the Scripture, we can't believe it. So if it's not there, don't tell me it's true. And this causes a big point. So they are who we call Puritans. They were trying to purify the English faith. They, by the way, were not trying to run away from the Anglican faith. They were trying to purify the faith that they had. But it didn't work out that way for them. And so King James decided to do his own Bible, and so he did. And so this one was replaced with the King James Version, 47 scholars, 33 months, 1611, King James Version. This really became the standard of the Christian church probably until, I don't know, 1900 or so, when a lot of other translations begin to come out. Still in wide use by some people in the church. So anyway, King James had this idea. But these separatists really didn't like that because it really didn't go far enough for them. And so they began to be persecuted, and they fled to Holland. They organized into two groups. One come to the American colonies. The others do eventually, but they become what we call Baptists today. The first ones are what we call pilgrims. So these Puritans are you know, who are driven out are pilgrims. But they're separatists, not Puritans. Puritans are the other group that fought against the church. So the pilgrims come in, and we think of pilgrims and Puritans, and we don't know the difference. They're both separatists. They're both Protestants, if you will, from the Anglican church and from the Roman church, but they have different views. Some of them are harder on some things than they are on other. The other group became known as Baptists, and I'm going to spend some time on that. John Smith was the early leaders. He moved to adult baptism or believer's baptism. And a lot of this, after he died, they formed England's First Baptist Church, which is called First Baptist Church of England. It's kind of interesting. But one of their famous guys was John Bunyan. And if you know him, when he married his wife, it was custom to get a big dowry. And what she came with was two Puritan books. But those Puritan books actually converted him. He read those books, and he became convicted of God, and he was baptized into a Baptist church in 1653. And we know him because of the book Pilgrim's Progress. He was an English Baptist writer. And you know, a lot of intolerance in England at this time, and that's why Pilgrim's Progress is written in cloaked language. You know, it's all symbolism. It's pretty easy to see, but it's all symbolism. But after he died, some tolerance returned to England. Now, at 1600, well, we know the Jamestown colony. We know a lot of things are happening. But before that, Columbus sets out and he comes to America. He doesn't really find America. He finds, you know, Hispaniola or whatever. And he calls it San Salvador, which is Holy Savior. And so he thinks he's found a route to the east. And because of that, the Portuguese and the English decide they better get busy and man their fleets up and sail and start finding land. But the Pope's mad at the English. So what he does is he takes a map and he draws a line down the map. Everything to the east of it is Portugal's. Everything to the west of it is Spain's. The line happens to go right down through South America, and that's why Brazil is a Portuguese colony and not a Spanish colony, if you ever wondered that. So everything to the west was Spanish. Portuguese settled all over other lands and put ports and stuff in everywhere. And then the Spanish went, you know, further to the east. And, of course, the English were left out. But the English didn't stay left out very long. Puritans, Pilgrims, Anabaptists, Brethren, Moravians, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Anglicans, Lutherans, others came over because they were running away from the Church of England and the Roman Church into a place where they could practice their faith without being persecuted. And they are all over the East Coast. If you look at various towns, you'll see where they are. Puritans are most notably up in the Boston area. They changed dramatically over the next couple of hundred years. We'll talk about that. The Pilgrims were sort of in the middle part of America. The Anabaptists and the Brethrens landed in probably in Virginia, and they populate Ohio, they populate Pennsylvania, they populate Kentucky, North Carolina, all of those, as far as Indiana, all of these congregational churches. Lutherans went north, right? Went north, and they went over, and they're in. They like northern stuff, cold stuff, so they were up in the hinterlands out in North and South Dakota, Darrell, and Minnesota and Wisconsin, and, you know, the far reaches of the upper Northeast as well. And so all of these folks began to settle in various places around the country, and they attempted to set up colonies based on their preferences. The Moravians were big in Georgia, by the way. We'll talk about that later, but they were big in Georgia, in Fort Oglethorpe and around that area, and they were very instrumental in the education of John Wesley when he came over here, who's the father of Methodism, if you will. So what is a Puritan? And I know I'm running tight, so we're going to quit here in just a minute. Is it a Holy Joe? Is it a religious snob? Is it, you know, H.L. Mencken, a newspaper guy, said that Puritans have the haunting fear that somewhere, someplace, somebody may be happy, and they're going to try to stomp it out, you know. And that's the view we all have of Puritans, but that's not the way they started. They really weren't straight-laced. They were very deeply convicted about what they believed. They thought that being reborn made them different, and they had to act different and be different. They couldn't associate and do the things other people did. So the behaviors were behaviors of a child of God. They were people of the book, and they were also people by the book. They sort of lived by the book. But they had a public and a private side of their faith. Their public faith was that they thought that they ought to impress their way of thinking on everybody else, and that their way of thinking would become the norm in the society. But they had a private side as well, which is a very faithful, humble side. But we've, you know, because of a lot of the influence of secular writers, you know, we've kind of gotten a little bit different view of Puritans over the years than that. But what happened is all of these people came, and they were no longer willing to die for an old idea. The old idea was it's either the Roman Church or it's nothing, or it's the Lutheran Church or it's nothing, and we're willing to kill each other to save that. They weren't willing to do that. They were children of God. They didn't believe in killing other people, so they wanted. They were no longer the same. They had a little broader thought and tolerance. They tolerated each other a little better. They never forced adherence to one another's faith, but we began to see in America a lot of things develop: cult, sects, mainline religions, fringe groups. All things happening, and what the answer was what we call today denominations, and those really didn't come into play until about 1700. So now we think of the Lutherans as a denomination. We think of the Roman Catholics as a denomination, not as the church that governs the world. We think of the Greek Orthodox as a denomination, the Mennonites. We think of all of them as denominations, and that's a subcategory of believer then it's just different from us. And, you know, we may argue about beliefs, but we don't kill each other for it. So the whole idea of a global enforced faith began to disappear. And that set the stage for America as the flowers begin to bloom and all these different faiths begin to take root here. For good or bad, denominations are here. We could argue, probably there's some things we would argue about are good or bad about denominations. But because of the change in what happened in the world, denominations were the answer to the problems plaguing the church. Next week we're going to cover the age of revival and reason. I'm going to shorten some of these because I really want to get to this one, where are we going? These are the things that really influenced the founding of America and influenced the way our founders set up America. And they're real important for you to understand, because the things that make us American are different from the things that make French French or English English. We're a little different. And a lot of it comes out of this early early work. So any questions, any comments, any thoughts? I know it's long. I know I kept you longer than I should, but I wanted to get through it.
We'll say you an indulgence.
Yeah, please do. Can I put a down payment on just a couple for future sins?
Where did the Quakers come from?
The Quakers came out of the Brethren sect. They are part of Congregationalists, the same people that are Mennonites. They all come out of a real humble background where they don't go into for a lot of trappings. You know, they're kind of, they're not monastic, but they're communal. They live in communities. They take care of one another. They're just a little bit different offshoot. There's probably a few different beliefs in there between a Shaker and a Quaker and a, the Mennonites and all of those, the Amish, but they're very close. They're all out of that congregational or that Brethren movement that came over here from the Dutch Reform area.
The Amish still speak German. Is that typical?
It is. They speak English too. But they speak German because at home they want to keep their native tongue alive, and so they speak German. My guess is if you took them to Germany, the German would probably not be as pure. You know, and to tell you that, you know, if you translate things today and you go to Quebec and you put it in French Quebec, well, that's not the same as Parisian French. Parisian French was frozen in time 200 years ago and moved to Quebec, and that's what they still speak. But the language has moved on in France, but it hasn't there. And so they, you know, they're separated by a common tongue, so to speak. And so I'm sure the Germans are the same way. I'm sure it's kind of a mix of Dutch and, you know, early Jewish settlers here spoke German. They spoke, Yiddish, which is kind of a colloquial German. And they may mix English with Yiddish. And, you know, we've even adopted that as part of our own language today, a lot of Yiddish terms.
So it's just different dialects.
Different dialects. Other questions? Other comments? Okay. Let's have a word of prayer and then we'll shut this thing off. Lord, we just thank you for this time that we can come and share. And Lord, we thank you that the church has survived all of these trials over the years. And Lord, it tells us very clearly that your hand is in your people. And the church age that we live in now is an age that you've ordained to take us to a certain place in time. And Lord, we're coming to that place, but you've kept this church alive. You've kept refocusing on its vital faith. And Lord, you've kept us asking the questions that help us secure the faith that we believe, because we understand what we think and what we believe and why we believe it. Lord, thank you for this group here, and I just pray for the safety of everyone here as they travel home. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.